Hey, everybody. It's time for the With a Bullet podcast. My name is Todd Golden. Matt Golden. Matt, how's life?
Not too bad. The Brewers are playing in the playoffs right now, and it's actually International Podcast Day.
Is it really?
Yes, it is.
What international flag are you flying in honor of that today?
Nepal.
Oh yeah, that's the one that's not rectangle.
Right. Yeah, it's like two triangles stuck together.
I'm flying the flag of a non sovereign nation. I'm flying the flag of Indiana.
Okay.
It wants to be its own country, but it can't. So
that would be weird if Indiana was independent.
Indiana would lose a lot of wars to a lot of its surrounding states if it was, I think.
Yeah, maybe I can see that. I mean, obviously outnumbered by Illinois
and Ohio and Michigan, but maybe they could beat up on Kentucky. Who knows? So anyway, this week it was my choice, and it was the alternative chart from September 29th, 1990. Matt, what'd you think of this one?
It was pretty interesting, I thought. I mean, it's kind of the 120 minutes era, or like the Dave Kendall era of 120 minutes, actually.
Yeah, and that's probably what most people remember about that show. It was, and I wasn't really into 120 minutes at this stage of the game. I was right on the dawn of sort of being into alternative music. September 1990, I would have been a sophomore at college living in a house for the first time, independent of my dorm. And so I was kind of in a musical state of flux at this point. I was definitely looking for, an alternative to the shit that was on the Hot 100, which, by the way, did you look at the Hot 100 chart from this week?
I glanced at it a little bit, just for my long distance dedication choice. So
it was hot garbage, but
but
I really didn't know where to turn to. I wasn't ready for quote unquote alternative music yet. So I can't say I was listening to much of this, but some of this would have been stuff I would have been listening to later. And I do remember hearing a lot of these songs on MTV at times, and not all of them, but most of them. So it was interesting. And it is the 120 minutes era too. So,
yep.
Anyway, where were you at? What grade were you in September 19th?
Let's see. I would have been probably about a month into seventh grade then. I was living in a suburb of Akron and Canton, Ohio. It's kind of like in between those two cities. So
just call it Green, because we both lived there.
Yeah. Green, Ohio. That's where I was.
So I just realized I pulled up the wrong chart for our thing this week, because I'm brilliant. So as I stall for time and watch the Brewers celebrate their 2-run home run, because this game, by the way, was looking like, I put this on Twitter. You know the phrase, bring a knife to a gunfight?
Yeah.
The way this game was early, it was like the Brewers brought a wiffle bat to a nuclear war.
Yep.
It was brutal.
Right. So,
we'll see, though. It's 3. For those of you following along at home, listening to the podcast, it is currently Dodgers 3, Brewers 2.
Okay.
In game one of whatever they're calling this round of the playoffs. So as I stall for time, as I pull up the correct chart, I had the R&B chart for some reason up from the same week. Okay, I got the real one. All right, let's get cracking.
Okay.
Number 30 is Leave Me Alone by the Cave Dogs.
This is power pop. It sounds similar to Matthew Sweet or the Posies. I couldn't really find out too much about these guys other than they were from Boston, and they opened up for a lot of similar bands, most of whom appear on this chart, so I'm not going to spoil it. Seriously, about half of their wiki entry was just a list of bands that they opened up for. And they also worked with David Cross early in his career. He kind of did stand-up comedy at their shows. So they've got that connection, but that's pretty much all I've got for these guys. This song isn't that bad. The video for it, I noticed with a lot of the videos on here, I went over like 90s videos, video cliches on one of our episodes, and seems like a lot of these videos were like a testing ground for some of those cliches. So there's like a lot of that going on in their video. There's like a clown puppet in it. There's trash blowing around. Everything's like fuzzy and staticky. So
is it lit in like fluorescent green?
They're playing in front of a test pattern. So
okay, that makes sense. Do dogs really live in caves? I guess they do out in the wild, maybe.
Yeah, they probably live in caves. I can see that.
I've never seen an actual cave dog.
Or a caveman could have had a dog, so that would have been a cave dog.
Were cavemen smart enough to domesticate dogs? I don't think so. They probably would have tried to eat them.
Yeah, it's probably too early for that. Yeah.
We've broken into anthropology here on the With a Bullet Pod.
Right. Yeah. But number 29 for you here, we have Bojo Nixon with Don Henley Must Die.
Yeah, song near and dear to my heart. Here's some of the lyrics I enjoy from this one. Quote, poet of despair, pumped up with hot air. He's serious, pretentious, and I just don't care. Quote, I'm only kidding. Can't you tell? I love his sensitive music. Idiot poetry, swell. Or, quote, you and your kind are killing rock and roll. It's not because you are OLD. It's because you ain't got a soul. So now, if you know who Mojo Nixon is, you have to, I obviously didn't even come close to doing justice to the way he does his vocals, but he's kind of a hell-raising Texan who basically recorded almost as a comedian as much as he did as a recording artist back in the late 80s and early 90s. And he was kind of a wild man and all of that. So, and he obviously didn't care much for Don Henley, which this came a year after Henley's solo peak. And so this was, and we're also at the height of Reagan-Bush conservatism too. And so this was actually controversial, even though it was, you know, pretty clearly, mostly anyway, tongue in cheek. And it was so controversial, his record company begged radio stations not to play it, which is not like, it's not like Mojo Nixon was getting a lot of radio airplay in the first place. But and as much as I actually agree with the sentiments of this song, Henley himself was really cool about it. He later on, a couple of years after this, he jumped on stage with Nixon and actually sang it with him, to which Nixon said in his inimitable deep Texas accented voice, he said, he's got balls as big as church bells. I don't know if he's directly quoted the Dragnet movie for that, but that's the first time I ever heard that. But Nixon was part of a really, really loosely defined, I guess, sort of scene from the late 80s, early 90s that I would call cult music. I don't know if there's a genre actually for this, but I sort of lump him in with the Dead Milkmen, Dread Zeppelin, My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult, the Cramps, and later on Primus and the Butthole Surfers, you know, bands that you really had a, I mean, they sort of had a humorous bent to them, but they also had some sort of psychotronic thing going with the way they were recording, probably less so with Mojo Nixon than some of those others, but it was usually intentionally humorous, but it had a cult movie vibe to it. So it's odd. I'm a big fan of cult movies, but I only have a real passing interest in this style of music. I guess I feel like that gets repetitive in music, whereas in movies, it's still pretty repetitive, but it seems right. Fresher. So Mojo Nixon these days is a DJ on Sirius XM. So I do hear him from time to time. He's on the Outlaw Country channel.
Oh, okay.
Mojo Nixon lives on in satellite radio land.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that I think of when I think of Mojo Nixon is Elvis needs boats.
Yes, Elvis does indeed need boats, which to this day I still quote that once in a while. So anyway, I do appreciate the fact that he did say that. I probably should have just read off the lyrics when we did that. When we did the podcast, it was about a couple months ago now, where we had Don Henley and I kind of went off on him. I should have just read the lyrics to this song. That would have been much more. That would have been more artful. So anyway, next up for you is number 28, Love or Something by Bob Geldof.
This is some Zydeco or Cajun-inspired roots rock from Mr. Live Aid. Lots of accordions on this. It was written with Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics. And Zydeco and Cajun music were kind of getting a lot of attention in the late 80s, early 90s for some reason. I think our dad even had a Cajun album at this point.
He did. He did.
Yeah. But it... I mean, it's not, this isn't that bad. I mean, it definitely sounds more 80s than 90s, and it seems out of place on this countdown. I mean, it seems more like something VH1 would play instead of like what would have been on like 120 minutes, but it's not too bad. So
honestly, I mean, it strikes me as like, Bob Geldof, I'll bet we need to stick him on the chart just to create some diversity on the alternative chart. It almost seems like it was like the fix was in on this, because I don't know that anybody in America ever listened to Bob Geldof very often, even like in the early late in the early 80s. Like when Live Aid happened, nobody knew who Bob Geldof was in America anyway. I mean, people in England,
right?
But you know, it's not like he ever had some massive amount of popularity. And that, and I can understand why, because everything I've ever heard by him has more or less sucked. But
song here is probably I don't Like Mondays, which is Boomtown Rat's song.
I would say Up All Night is the one Boomtown Rat song that did penetrate the MTV sphere of the early 80s. Because I do remember that song. But so... Up All Night. Ooh, I can't even do it. I haven't heard it in ages. So.
But it didn't really make it that far up this chart either. So, I mean, it's probably just, like you're saying, they probably just, like, stuffed it on here for some reason.
Paola, the picture of him on the Billboard chart I'm looking at makes him look like Bob Gandalf. Like gray hair and all that.
Yeah, I mean, he probably looks like that now. So, yep. But number 27 for you, we have The Darling Buds with Crystal Clear.
I've never heard of this until I did this countdown, but I'm kind of glad I got this one because it's pretty good. It has that dreamy early 90s UK quality to it. And The Darling Buds were from Wales, astride England. with Andrea Lewis Jarvis handling the vocals. And the best comparison I can make to their sound would be if you transplanted the mid-90s Cardigans to 1990 with kind of the faggy alternative tropes of 1990. So put them in the Fly Machine and you have the Darling Buds. So the video has some cool-ass 1990 CGI in it.
It
looks like the Darling Buds are stuck inside Lawnmower Man's computerized lair. That's basically the best way I can describe it. So this actually went pretty high in the modern rock chart. It reached number 5, but I don't remember ever once hearing this song, even watching 120 minutes. So but it's pretty good shit. I actually like this song. It was good.
Yeah, I didn't think it was that bad either.
Do you remember do you remember hearing it? Because I sure don't.
No, definitely not.
Cool. All right, we're in agreement on that. Hey, the Brewers drove Walker Buehler out of the game. Okay. It's going to be like the Harry Carey sketch from SNL, where I'm just all of a sudden jump in with a reference to the game. But anyway, okay. Keeping this on task. Number 26 for you is Heart Like a Wheel by the Human League.
Yeah, I skipped this. It sounds exactly like Human. I'm thinking this was probably one of their first singles. Actually, this is a skip too, but it's probably their first single since Human, and it basically just sounds like it. So,
well, Human would have been out several years before this, though, right?
That was out in like 86 or something like that.
That's what I thought. Well, the Human League obviously grew their sound a lot over the intervening 4 years.
Right. But I mean, I was disappointed because I had Dare on their album Dare on one of our shows, and that was actually pretty good, I thought. So, a little disappointed in this one, though.
Yeah.
But 25 for you, we have Social Distortion with Ring of Fire.
Well, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, by 1990, I was definitely looking for a way out of the pop and rock music that was popular at the time, and I mostly went down a classic rock path at this point, but I did attempt to adopt some contemporary bands as ones I could get behind. And at the time, Social Distortion was one of them. Though, in saying that, I never actually ever bought a single album of theirs. But this came from the same album as their breakthrough song, Ball and Chain. When I say breakthrough song, I mean it got played on MTV a little bit. But they were considered quote-unquote punk, but they were really only punk by the very non-punk tastes of 1990. I mean, they are definitely punk compared to like The Cure, I guess, or Depeche Mode, but you know, they're probably more roots rock than punk, I would say. But and being that this was 1990 and being that we're at the height of the Reagan-Bush conservatism, the album cover features a 1930s gangster, an empty liquor bottle in a drunk woman's hand, and a pinup putting on stockings. And this was considered to be controversial, even though I have no idea why. There's no like overt nudity on it or anything. And some stores actually refused to sell the album that this was on. So welcome to 1990. All in, by the way, full-on jewel box mode too. We had the big boxes still at this
point. Oh yeah, that's right, the long boxes.
The long boxes, which were a pain in the ass. I mean, they really were. It was like, why? I mean, they got rid of them allegedly for environmental reasons, but they could have just as easily got rid of them for practical reasons, because there was really no reason to have boxes that big. But
well the reason that they did that was because record stores could buy it and not like convert their shelves from vinyl.
Yeah, well, that didn't last too long, did it? So
no.
But now you got record stores trying to convert their CD areas to records. So
most of the stores in my city have like totally converted over. It's been a few months since I've been to a record store, but I mean, most of them were pretty much all vinyl.
The only quote-unquote record store where I live is basically a head shop run by a bunch of 70-year-old hippies, and it's terrible, so I never even go in there. Seriously, it's bad. Like, the best place to buy records here in Terre Haute is actually at, like, one of the antiques malls. There's, like, a stall in there with a bunch of albums. That place is pretty good, but
okay, there's an antique mall here in Madison that's kind of like that too.
Yeah, that place has legit albums. This one has like literally 90 albums total, and like 45 of them are Glenn Campbell or something. It's pretty bad. Anyway, right. Next up for you is number 24, "The King Is Half Undressed" by Jellyfish.
This is power pop again with some glam and psychedelic elements thrown in there. And at the time, Jellyfish were probably as known for like their outlandish 70s inspired costumes as they were for their music. The 90s revival that happened in, or the 70s revival that happened in the 90s hadn't really started in earnest. So it just seemed odd at the time, and they kind of looked like rejects from like a Sid and Martin Croft show, to tell you the truth. But They also had a singing drummer. And not only that, he played at the front of the stage. He had like a special kit where he stood up at the front of the stage. But ultimately, the group ended up imploding after their second album. And a lot of like power pop fans like swear by both of these albums, but they kind of imploded because the lead singer slash drummer wasn't really comfortable about being a front man, and everybody was like arguing over whose songs got on the albums. And two of the other guys in the band, Jason Faulkner and Roger Manning, kind of became 90s alt rock journeymen. Faulkner was in the Grays, who made a memorable appearance on Beavis and Butthead. And he also worked as a solo artist and did session work with Air and Amy Mann. And Roger Manning was in Imperial Drag, which actually made an appearance on one of our other alternative shows, and the Moog Cookbook. And they're both in Beck's backing band now, so they're both still playing, but decent song. So
I remember Jellyfish, and I remember not minding them, and but I couldn't, like, if you asked me to like identify a Jellyfish song, I'd have trouble. And since I've already scrolled away from this song, I couldn't even name what this song was, even though I literally just said it like 3 minutes ago.
They did have a hit that was bigger than this that they get like played like pretty regularly on MTV. I think it was called That Is Why.
That Is Why. Yeah, I do remember that song, but I couldn't have named it. Like, if I had a gun to my head, I'd get my brains blown out, basically. So,
yeah.
Truth hurts.
Yeah. Okay, at number 23, we have Jane's Addiction with Been Caught Stealing.
Well, on one hand, I sort of get why people were into Jane's. And this song, I guess, in particular, I mean, the guitar in this song is pretty good. It does rock. I mean, I'll give them that. But Jane's Addiction always left me cold because Perry Farrell was annoying to me as a front man. His look, mainly his voice, just the whole package just got on my nerves a little bit. And it's unfortunate I felt that way because he was actually a pretty good guy in real life, doing a lot of charitable work. But the whole vibe around Jane's was just, you know, there's a lot of bros, or who would be bros then? They wouldn't necessarily be bros now, that were into Jane's. Pretty early on, and this song was played ad nauseum on MTV too. That was another
part.
The video for this, a lot of people thought the video for this was amazing because it was like shot in a grocery store and all that. I mean, it was all right, but it wasn't like some world-changing video. But I did want to introduce a new feature this week, Matt.
Okay.
It's the Wikipedia Fun Fact of the Week, sponsored by the Department of Duh.
Okay.
Here we go. Angel Stadium in Anaheim, following along on the baseball theme we've already established, plays this clip whenever the Angels steal a base. There you go.
That's your
Wikipedia Fun Fact of the Week, sponsored by the Department of Duh. That's got to be a week. I'm making that a weekly feature.
Okay.
Decision to do that. So anyway, number 22 for you is So Hard, Boys.
This is a skip. It sounds like every other Pet Shop Boys song, so I'm just skipping it.
You've got the brains, I've got the brawn. Let's make lots of money.
Yep. Pretty good imitation there.
Do they say So Hard in the song? Because I don't remember this song.
I think so. I mean, I only listened to it like twice before I decided to skip it.
That's so. What she said. Get it? So I think we're up. I believe we're up to your long distance dedication.
Right? That is right. And at number 34 on this week's Hot 100, we have one of the most out of left field top 10 singles ever, Faith No More's Epic. And when I first saw this video, I just remember being totally confused about it. Are they rappers? Are they a metal band? What's with this guy's voice? How did they get on MTV? I was confused by it, but I was also kind of fascinated by it because it was such an outlier. I mean, nothing that got played on heavy rotation on MTV in the afternoons and the fall of 1990 sounded like this. I mean, like, absolutely nothing sounded like it. It was its own thing. And in the back of my mind, I also thought that maybe music was going to sound like this from now on. Maybe future. Well, it wasn't, but arguably it was the first rap metal single. So it was the start of everything that happened in the late 90s. And Chris Novoselic was actually quoted as saying that their success may have helped kick in the door for Nirvana. So they have that. And of course, you have to talk about the video for this. It's pretty striking. There's floating eyeballs, lightning bolts, paint flying around, things blowing up, rained on. And there is a part that caused a bunch of controversy. There's a dying fish flapping around outside of the water, which a lot of animal lovers weren't really thrilled about. And at the time, the band joked that they stole the fish from Bjork at a party. But apparently it wasn't totally a joke, because Bjork actually did give their keyboardist a fish as a gift at one point. But if it was her fish, there weren't any hard feelings, because later on, Mike Patton, the lead singer, ended up making a guest appearance on one of her albums. But pretty unique song, and I just like to dedicate this to Fish, I guess. So
to Fish the band or Fish the animal?
The animal, okay. not the band.
I did not care for this song really much at all, because this falls into that same bro-ish thing that Jane's Addiction drew. I actually would not have placed these songs at the same time. I'm actually kind of surprised they were sort of in the same universe at the same time. I would have placed Been Caught Stealing like a year after this if I would have been asked. But I did like Falling to Pieces.
Yeah, that's what I would have thought too.
Falling to Pieces, which was the single by Faith No More after this, was when I was like, all right, I get what these guys are going for. Because they were a weird mix. They had a bunch of guys who were, you know, basically, I suppose, alternative type guys. And then their guitarist, I think his name was Jim Martin, if I remember right.
Right, yep.
Was like sort of a disciple of Black Sabbath and all that. So they did have this sort of weird mix to them. So
right, and I think Jim Martin was in like one of the precursors to Metallica.
Yeah, so that's where they get their thrash sound from. But, you know, but yeah, this song was definitely different.
Yeah, exactly. It's number 21 for you. We have Los Lobos with Down on the Riverbed.
I took 2 years of Spanish, Matt, and Los Lobos is Spanish for the Lobos.
they named their band after New Mexico's football team.
No, they named them after Sheriff Lobo from Sheriff Lobo.
They named him after Lobo.
Yeah, the band Lobo, right. me and you and a dog named Boo. A lot of people say Lobos actually means wolves, but it actually just means Lobos. But this song sounds like a combination of Stevie Ray Vaughan and solo Keith Richards, which I guess is a compliment. I mean, the Keith Richards part of it would be. But so it's not Chicano rock at all, which is what Los Lobos were known for. It's a blues song. And Los Lobos are probably a band I would really like a lot if I explored them, but I never really bothered to.
Mm-hmm.
As I was researching this song, I did go on a little bit of a Los Lobos hunt around Spotify and YouTube. And I did find one cool song of theirs, which was a cover of Bob Dylan's Billy One from the pretty great and underrated movie directed by Sam Peckinpah, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, which Bob Dylan did the score for. It's a band I ought to explore more. And bringing up Bob Dylan reminds me that last week they did a marathon of his Theme Time Radio Hour show on XM Sirius, and that was awesome. I don't recall hearing Los Lobos on it, but it was really cool to hear that show again after it had been off the air for like 10 years. So
I've never had satellite radio, so I haven't heard it, but I've heard good things about that show.
I don't know that those are available in any kind of format. I know the episode he recorded, that the reason they brought it back is he recorded an episode, I think, to promote some whiskey thing that he's doing. So he did a whiskey related episode that is actually on Spotify. I don't think any of the other episodes are. I mean, I don't know if they're on YouTube or what, but you should go seek them out. That's actually a really good show. I never fail to hear a song on there. And he goes through the whole 20th century of music. I mean, he goes way back into like, you know, the 30s and 40s and all that. And it's a really interesting show. He actually makes a really good DJ, believe it or not. So there's my recommendation for the week.
Yeah.
Anyway, next up for you, number 20 is Everybody Knows by Concrete Blonde.
This is a Leonard Cohen cover. He put out his version a couple years before this, and this appeared on the soundtrack of Pump Up the Volume. And to summarize the plot of Pump Up the Volume, Christian Slater plays a high school loner who runs a pirate radio station out of his bedroom. And he says a lot of things that upset the man. And his theme song is Leonard Cohen's original version of this song. And it plays every so often throughout the movie. And Concrete Blonde's version plays over the credits. The song's pretty repetitive. Every line starts with Everybody Knows. And it's not really cheerful. I mean, the dice are loaded. Everybody knows the good guy is lost. The fight was fixed. The boat is sinking. The plague's coming, and so on. And the versions are a little bit different. Cohen's has like really lousy late 80s production with like cheesy synth strings. The best comparison I can think of is In Excesses Never Tear Us Apart. And Concrete Blondes is kind of like the rock version of it. Or at least as much rock as you can get with a song. And their lead singer, Jenna Napolitano, has pretty deep, raspy voice. It's probably the closest woman can sound to Leonard Cohen, but it's like the 60s version of Leonard Cohen. By this point, I mean, like the original version of this, I mean, it's like barely odd. I mean, it's just like total gravel voice. Basically, but this was also covered by Don Henley too, so Mojo Nixon probably wasn't a fan of that one. So.
No problem. I want to do a whole movie marathon of movies released around 1989 or 90 that railed against the man, which are basically aimed for my age, and just laugh at them.
Oh yeah, and actually, since I mentioned Mojo Nixon, he was actually in one. Rock and Roll High School Forever.
Well, that's more of a cash in. I'm thinking like Pump Up the Volume. I haven't seen Heathers in a while. Heathers is funny as hell, but I wonder how, like, some of the messages of that movie are probably pretty dated though. And just have a fun little, hey, remember when we were the young generation fighting for against, you know, the establishment, which the establishment back in those days was, they really were a kinder, gentler America compared to now. But
Oh yeah, definitely.
I would trade places with 1990 in that respect. But so yeah, but I don't think I've ever seen Pump Up the Volume though. I don't know how I missed on that one.
I've only seen like bits and pieces of it when it's been like on cable, so never seen it all the way through. But what I told you is pretty much the entire movie.
So. Christian Slater, man, he was hot in 1990.
Yep. But what number are we on here? 19. Number 19, we have Soho with Hippie Chick.
Well, this starts with a sample of The Smiths, How Soon Is It Now? And it seemed like the goal of every song that came out in the UK from like basically after How Soon Is Now came out to about 93 or so was to replicate the beginning of that song. Soho wasn't the only band to sample it. The Cure did it too in Fascination Street, if I can learn how to talk. So it has that. And then it also breaks into a Soul to Soul sample. And basically, Soho, which is the Cuff Sisters, Jackie and Pauline from England, they're basically singing over the top of those two samples is what it boils down to. Mm-hmm. I guess it qualifies as trip hop. It's early trip hop, I suppose. And I definitely would not have been into trip hop in 1990, though I do kind of like it now, honestly. Mm-hmm. But even back then, I didn't really mind this song. It also had a little bit of baggy to it. We'll get into baggy later on this. So it had a little bit of a little dash of Madchester to it, even though it was basically just a studio song. So had a little bit of a dreamlike quality to it too. So it was all right. I didn't mind it.
Yeah, it's not bad. I mean, I actually like it better than How Soon Is Now. Out of all of the Smiths singles, that's probably my least favorite one too. So
anyway, next up, 18 is Violence of Summer by Duran Duran.
I totally forgot about this song. This was their comeback. It actually got quite a bit of airplay on MTV at the time, which MTV had moved on from Duran Duran. They were pretty much just playing like CNC Music Factory and MC Hammer and like the worst hair metal had to offer at this point. But that airplay on MTV didn't really translate into this actually becoming a mainstream hit. It actually stalled outside of the top 40. Their actual comeback would come a couple years after this with Come Undone and Ordinary World. And they were down to just three of the original members at this point. Just Simon LeBond, John Taylor, and Nick Rhodes. Essentially Arcadia with a different Taylor. And song is a lot better than I remembered it being. It has like the classic 80s Duran Duran feel to it. And they add like a Farfisa Oregon on top of it. It's pretty good. I mean, I definitely prefer it to their actual comeback singles from a couple years after this. And the video for this is like the only video that I had on my side of the list that actually looked like it had any sort of money put into it. Duran Duran's playing at like a really elaborate like stage set. And then there's like models dressed up like bikers and they're doing like biker type stuff. And the other half of the video, they have like supermodels and like bad blonde wigs flirting with the bikers. So probably took a lot of money just to get the supermodels involved with it, but not bad. I mean, I didn't mind this one. So
I actually didn't mind Ordinary World, which what was that, 92 when that came out?
It was 92 or 93.
That song was all right. I didn't mind that song.
Yeah, it ended up getting played a bit too much, though. I mean, you heard it all the time. Actually, you still hear it a lot. So
I say it didn't get played enough.
Oh, okay, then. But 17 for you, we have Depeche Mode with The World in My Eyes.
I mean, I think Depeche Mode's, like, in hindsight, I think their 1980s output is probably much more well-liked. But they were at the height of their popularity right about at this point in 1990. Violator was the album that this came off of, which saying that sounds like I'm talking about Hot Tub Time Machine because one of the one of the characters' names was Violator. But anyway, you should go see that movie. It's funny. But
Hot Tub Time Machine, I have seen that movie.
Yeah, that movie's great.
Yeah.
I lost my train of thought. So, okay, they were at the height of their popularity. And though this song was nowhere near as big as Personal Jesus or Enjoy the Silence or Policy of Truth, which was actually number 20 on the Hot 100 this week, this song is much more emblematic of their core sound with the very sharp cheddar synths. And so this sounds more like classic Depeche Mode, like this could have been recorded in 1985 or something like that. So, but Depeche Mode videos crack me up from this period because somehow Depeche Mode thought, let's make Dave Mahan into like a cock rock god, you know, like in all the videos of the time. And he looks like, he basically looked a lot like I would have if I would have wore glasses back then, you know. I mean, yeah. He was not some sort of sex symbol or anything like that. And yet you go into these videos and he's like wearing leather chaps and showing off his chest and stuff like that. Like he was so desirable to everybody. So it cracks me up. But there's a little bit of that in this video. It's not as much as like, say, Personal Jesus or anything like that. But it is still funny. So Depeche Mode, cock rockers.
Well, they like... God, it was like in 95 they did put out like a rock single.
I feel you. Yeah, I actually didn't mind that song, but no, that was more like 92 or 93. But
I think you're right. Yeah,
but yeah, that was, see, Depeche Mode started messing with their sound in 1990, which probably made commercial sense because I don't think they could have lasted doing just the pure synthesizer type stuff. So,
oh yeah, definitely not. So
anyway, next up for you, number 16 is Valuria by the Pixies.
This has always been my favorite Pixies song. Everything that makes the Pixies great is in this one. You have like the soaring lead guitar, the simple bass line, the ethereal Kim Deal background vocals, the quiet loud dynamic, and to be honest, most of their songs have that. It just works the best here. And the song appears to be a simple love song. But because this is Frank Black or Black Francis, as he was being called back then, there is a deeper, weirder meaning to this. It's a love song, but it was written for a woman from the lost continent of Lemuria. Lemuria is the Pacific equivalent to Atlantis. And according to the Rosicrucians, the Lemurians ended up living in an underground city beneath Mount Shasta in California after their continent sank. And it's referenced a couple times in the songs with the lines, how does lemur skin reflect the sea? And forever green, I know she's in California. I can see the tears of Shasta's sheen. So, yeah, it's about Lemurians, I guess. But it's the video for this is extremely low budget. The whole thing is the band running slow-mo through a quarry. And the only reason they made it was because this was heading up the charts in the UK. And they had a chance to be on Top of the Pops, but they couldn't appear on the Top of the Pops unless they had an actual video to go along with their single. So they like slapped this together in like 10 minutes, like it, when they're like going in between tour stops. But actually, even though it's like super low budget, it's actually a halfway decent video too. But Valuria is also a baby name now too, probably due to like Pixies fans naming their kids Valuria, but there are actually 41 Valurias in the US right now.
Wow. It's a wave of
popularity. If you type in Valuria into Google, the first result is a baby name site. So.
So which song is better when it comes to Lost Civilizations, this or Atlantis by Donovan?
I prefer this one, but the outro to Atlantis is definitely much better.
Oh, yeah? Well, I bet there's not a lyric like this. On board with a 12, the poet, the physician, the farmer, the scientist, the magician, and the other so-called gods of our legends, though gods they were, and as the elders of our time choose to remain blind, let us rejoice and sing and dance and ring in the new. Hail Atlantis! Let's go kill a mobster.
Yes, yeah.
Billy Bats is fucked.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But he got his revenge in Casino as a different character.
He did. He did. Took a bat to, you know, where that actually really happened. I drive by it all the time on Highway 41 in Indiana.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
I actually literally know, like, where. It's like maybe a mile off of Highway 41 if you're going through Enos, Indiana, is where that happened. Like the real execution. And that's exactly what happened, too. They took a bat to him and his brother and buried him in a cornfield out there.
Jeez, yep.
I love that we segued from Lost Civilizations to Donovan to Goodfellas to True Crime. That was awesome.
Yes, exactly. But number 15 here, we have Soul Asylum with Spinnin'.
Well, this is one of my skips because I have a very similar band from a similar lineage coming up shortly.
Okay, yep.
So that leads us to number 14 for you, Good Morning Britain by Aztec Camera.
I always confuse Aztec Camera with the Lightning Seeds, probably because they're both one-man bands, but when I saw this, I was like, oh, it's the Football's Coming Home guy. But no, it's the other guy. It's Aztec Camera. And on this track, he's teamed up with Mick Jones from The Clash, or in 1990, who would have been from Big Audio Dynamite 2. But anyway, I listened to this before I read up on it. And as I was listening to it, I was thinking, God, this guy sounds exactly like Mick Jones. Well, lo and behold, it was. But Roddy Frame, who was the guy in Aztec Camera, and Mick Jones kind of alternate lines in the song, kind of almost as a call and response. Yeah. And Frame had kind of like a rough, heavily accented voice. So it's a little bit like Joe Strummer. So it's kind of Clash-like, but it's 90s Clash. And it's a protest song about the state of Britain, Thatcher, the Troubles, Wales and Scotland getting the shaft, police brutality, racism, homophobia. It's a pretty decent song, but I mean, like I said, it is basically, I mean, kind of 90s update of The Clash, but yeah.
You know who I get Aztec Camera mixed up with?
Who?
Quetzalcoatl. Okay. That's the winged serpent from Aztec legend.
That is, yeah, yeah, you're right about that.
Aztecs supposedly invented basketball, or they had a version that was sort of like basketball, except for when you lost, you got sacrificed to the gods.
Yep.
That would definitely motivate you.
Yeah. But I wouldn't want to be one of the players, though. I mean, there's like a 50-50 chance.
I know. And I suck at basketball, so I'd definitely be going out real quick.
Right.
Unless I played you. So
that is true. That is true. Put-ump, yeah.
Put-ump, bump. Rim shot.
But number 13, we have Jane's Addiction with Stop.
Well, I'm skipping this because I've already talked about Jane's Addiction, so no need to mine again, whatever I was going for there.
Okay.
But this leads us, we're off, because we only have 30 spots on the chart this week, our long-distance dedications are in weird spots, so it's time for mine.
Okay, all right.
I went to the album chart for mine, since this chart literally only has 30 songs on it. I'm going to go to the number 70 spot on the album chart from that chart, and that would be the Sex Packets album by Digital Underground.
Okay.
And if you're wondering what I was listening to in September 1990, this would have been among the albums I listened to a lot. My roommate had it, and he put it on a lot, and it fascinated me. And it still does fascinate me, actually, because this is one of the very earliest hip-hop concept albums. But the concept is so weird and so out there, it's pretty funny. So sex packets are actually glowing pills, like blue pills, which they show on the album cover, that knocked you out and simulated sex in your mind. The pills were called GSRA, genetic suppression relief antidotes. And according to the concept of the album, they were supposedly designed by NASA at Stanford for astronauts to use when they were in space, so they could have sex. So the liner notes even provide like the backstory of sex packets, claiming it was surreptitiously kind of released underground to clubs in the inner cities to see, basically as a test market for sex packets, which in the album, if you listen to that concept, there is a song called Packet Man, which where Shock G is selling to Humpty Hump, selling sex packets. It's a good song. Actually, Shock G is also Humpty Hump, but we'll get to that. But at the time in 1990, I was so gullible that I thought these might actually be real. And it was some sort of like inner city culture thing I just didn't know about. Like, oh, wow, you know, I've been living in the suburbs. I'm pretty sheltered. I wonder if you can get your hands on these sex packets. So I was a complete idiot. But but what Digital Underground, who is really just Greg Jacobs, a.k.a. Shock G, as I mentioned, it was really just him playing a bunch of personas, including the most famous one, which was Humpty Hump, who did the Humpty Dance and all that. Yeah. But what he was going for was to be the spiritual successors to Parliament Funkadelic. And in that, they largely succeeded in that mission, because the whole concept of this album is straight out of the P-Funk dictionary, basically. I mean, they did weird concepts like this too back in the 70s. And then when you look at what Digital Underground actually sampled in the 90s, I mean, at least 50% of it was P-Funk stuff, if not like close to 75%, especially their late 70s stuff, like anything off of One Nation Under a Groove or Uncle Jam Wants You. Those albums have those heavy bass grooves on them. And basically, George Clinton was unknowingly creating Digital Underground sound. Of course, it's the way around. But honestly, Digital Underground was probably my very first exposure to P-Funk at all. And just that deep bass groove that Digital Underground managed to get in their records was a nice primer for my later fascination with P-Funk. So, of course, this album features Humpty Dance, which is one of the best and most fun jams from the golden age of hip-hop. It probably has the best sample of all time in it, I think. That almighty looping beat that basically defines the song. And it actually consists of Sly and the Family Stone's Sing a Simple Song and P-Funk's theme from The Black Hole, and then some instrumental garnishes that Shock G did himself. So it's not one single sample. He combined a bunch of different things to create that loop. But Digital Underground were funky as fuck. And, you know, thanks to the P-Funk connection, they were pretty cool. They kind of did try to also create the vibe of a big, large group and with characters and stuff like that. So it was really cool. I still enjoy them. So I was actually listening to the Sex Packets album last night while figuring out what I wanted to do for my dedication, and it holds up. It's actually really good. So dedicate this to Sex Packets, thinking they're real. The Packet Man, Humpty Hump, and Shock G, they're worth it. So this is good stuff.
The Burger King bathroom.
Burger King bathroom. I use a word that don't mean nothing, like Loop did. I love that. At the time, I love that. I was like, damn, that's just genius. Because they're basically sending up rap, too. I mean, that was part of the genius of that song that's lost now is, you know, in many ways, the Humpty Dance and a lot of what Digital Underground did was pretty much the first counter reaction to a lot of the gangster rap and braggadocious rap that like LL Cool J did and Cool Moe Dee. I mean, 70% of rap in those days was just guys bragging on record is what it really was.
Yeah. So yeah, kind of
Digital Underground, De La Soul were among the groups that were the counterweight against that. So that's what's kind of lost about Humpty Dance, is that was sort of the intent of that song at the time, including making fun of just some of the rhymes that some of the DJs did back then, you know, to be tough. So,
right.
But yeah, So good stuff. And I should mention, they basically launched Tupac's career for you.
That's right. Yeah, he was like, he was a member under like EP that they put out after this.
He was
in Nothing But Trouble with them.
He was. You'd never know it based on Tupac's au revoir, but yes, he came out of Digital Underground. So
yeah,
Digital Underground were a little bit more fun than Tupac. Plus, the other nugget of this, Shock G follows me on Twitter too, which I think is cool.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I have Shock G and Chuck D follow me on Twitter, which those have to be the two coolest Twitter followers I have.
Right. Yeah. I
apologies to all the normal people who follow me on Twitter, but actually, Matt, you're the coolest person who follows me on Twitter.
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks.
I know. Aw. Anyway, my daughter's looking at me because she follows me on Twitter with her mouth agape right now. Sorry. Anyway, number 12 for you is One Love by the Stone Roses.
Stone Roses were the band that most people associate with the whole Manchester baggy second summer of love scene of like the late 80s, early 90s UK. And this song is pretty typical of that sound. Has like a drum machine styled beat, even though it wasn't really a drum machine. It was played by their drummer Rennie. And there's a swirling, almost like psychedelic, flanged out guitar solo kind of running throughout the entire song. And the lead vocals are practically whispered, and the whole thing sounds like it was recorded underwater. It's about what you'd expect if you'd ever heard these guys before. And this was a standalone single, and it ended up being the last song that these guys would record for about 4 years. Because they were signed to a little indie label in the UK, and they were offered a huge deal by Geffen Records to leave, but the original label wouldn't let them go, so turned into a huge legal battle, so they were forced to sit out for a few years. But this was their biggest hit in the UK, and we actually covered their biggest hit in the States on our 1995 alternative episode, Love Spreads, which that break basically ruined the band, according to most of their fans. Like, their second album often comes up on like the worst lists of like the worst sophomore albums, or like the biggest decline from like the first album to the second album, and they ended up like breaking up almost immediately after that one was released. So, but this was when they were at their peak. And the video, they're playing in front of a wall of flames for some reason, and everything's like pixelated out, which is, I mean, kind of a like 90s video trope, I guess, but not a bad song though. I didn't mind this one. So
yeah, Stone Roses are okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty, I mean, this one was actually pretty similar to Fool's Gold, which is probably like their best known song, period. So similar to that. But
yeah.
Anyway, number 11 here, we have The Replacements with Merry-Go-Round.
Minnesota rock, Matt.
Yep.
Let's drive up to the land of 10,000 lakes and rock out, because Minnesota is not just the reserve of Prince or Bob Dylan. This was the height of rock coming out of the land of the Swedes. But so you had Soul Asylum, which we mentioned, I skipped earlier because I didn't want to repeat all this shit twice. But you have somebody coming up very soon, Bob Mould.
Yes.
Who came out of Husker Du from Minnesota. And then later on, he formed Sugar. And then The Replacements, who were probably the best known out of all of them. And they were definitely the most popular out of all those bands at this point, too, by far.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the bands from that Minnesota scene started out as hardcore, which I find most of that stuff totally unlistable. Even back then, I found it unlistable, and much less now. But all of them, for some reason, basically morphed into sort of power pop artists for some reason I can't really explain. And The problem with the replacements was is that they went this direction earlier than some of their peers did, and they broke mainstream quite a bit earlier than any of those other bands did. And so by 1990, it felt like they were sort of repeating themselves. And they had a lot of problems within the band. This was actually from their last album they recorded in their original, you know, with their original group members. And by then, they really were dominated by Paul Westerberg, their lead singer, who was basically the one who took them into this power pop direction. So they feel tired. They don't feel like, you know, and a lot of this is hindsight speaking, because I do remember when the song was out. But, you know, you could, looking back on it, you could tell this is pretty much the end of the road for the Replacements. And let's put it this way, this won't be a song that they're remembered for either. It's pretty mediocre.
Oh, yeah, definitely not.
And plus, Paul Westerberg's vocals have this weird effect on him. I mean, it was probably intended to simulate going around in circles, merry-go-round, but it just makes it sound like somebody fucked up in the studio. I mean, it doesn't sound good, whatever they were going for. So Replacements are a good band, but they were at the end of the road at this point. Mm-hmm. And Paul Westerberg went on to have some solo success in the 90s. He was big on the singles soundtrack and all that, but... you know, by the mid 90s, he was pretty much kaput as well. So,
But I actually, since he mentioned their hardcore stuff, I actually prefer the Replacements' hardcore stuff.
I mean, it's fun.
Well, like, fuck school. I hate music. I bought a headache. It's
fun when you're like 20 years old. It's not fun when you're 30 like I am now. I don't know. I've never had much time for hardcore by anybody, much less the Replacements or anybody else. That's just a genre I just have never been able to see the value in, I guess.
Right. But I mean, they're, even when they were like kind of moving into stuff like this, I think that their first album that was kind of like this still included a Kiss cover and a song called Gary's Got a Boner. So they did kind of hold on to the goofiness
for one album, and then they basically morphed into the 80s college rock band in the late 80s parlance. But and then really that went to power pop. So it didn't last very long. And part of that was the influence of Westerberg. Part of it was because some of the, like Tommy Stinson, some of the members of the Replacements were just non-functional human beings, basically. I mean,
pretty much. You know. They were pretty much like that from the beginning. I mean, it was basically like if your high school started a band.
Right. So anyway, but Minnesota rock was a big deal, and I don't know. I mean, I guess it's remembered, but you know, you don't, it's not the first thing people think about with Minnesota. Now, naturally, Prince, you know, obviously is a gigantic figure and all that. But it's, you know, they had a legitimate scene going. So,
Yeah.
More so than our state has ever had.
That is definitely true. Yeah.
So, anyway, next up for you, the aforementioned Bob Mould with It's Too Late.
Yeah, well, member of Husker Du coming right after the Replacements. And... you mentioned this before, but he was also in Sugar after this, and this was kind of like in the 2-year gap between those two bands. And this is power pop. It has a Kinks-style riff. It almost reminds me a little bit of the Kinks song Back Where We Started, which was probably about 5 years before this. But you can almost imagine Husker Du doing this one. It's... similar to like their later stuff, and Mould sings the background vocals on this too, and you can tell that he's kind of trying to emulate his old bandmate Grant Hart a little bit. But the gist of this song is that we're already screwed. It's kind of similar to Everybody Knows in that way, but it's about like the environment, AIDS, and so on. And it's more explicit in the video. And Mould's kind of wondering, like, if he's the only one who knows that we're screwed. But
that was the theme of a lot of songs in 1990. I mean, George Michael's Praying for Time jumps to mind. And there was a lot of kind of apocalyptic type songs like that in that period for some reason.
Yeah, and it's weird because, I mean, that time period didn't really seem, I mean, wasn't, I mean, it didn't seem like apocalypse was going to happen at any point.
Well, I guess looking back, the Soviet Union hadn't broken up yet, although it was in the process of doing it, and so, I don't know.
See, but one funny thing about this video, though, is Bob Mould is wearing a University of South Carolina Cox t-shirt.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which, it's kind of hilarious because I've always associated that with like the douchiest of frat boys.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously Bob Mould isn't a frat boy.
So. No, I'm sure there was an ironic meaning to that. A guy wearing a Cox shirt would be into Jane's Addiction.
Yeah, probably. Probably.
Or Faith No More for that matter.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's true. But number 9 for you, we have the Cocteau Twins with Ice Blink Luck.
The Cocteau Twins were a 3-person Scottish group consisting of Robin Guthrie, Simon Ramond, and vocalist Elizabeth Fraser. This song is from the album Heaven or Las Vegas, which was their first stateside album after being part of the UK scene for most of the 80s. But it's too bad that this song wasn't on last week's countdown, because remember last week I was talking about which 1976 songs freaked me out.
Mm-hmm.
And Fraser's vocals definitely freaked me out on this one, because she sounds at times like she's basically singing in tongues over the top of late 80s UK synth music.
Oh, and yeah.
The Cocteau Twins had that kind of Susie and the Banshees vibe about them because of Fraser. And I've never been into Susie and the Banshees. I've never quite understood the whole vibe of what they're all about. But this definitely also struck me as a song that practically defined what you would have heard if you would have turned on 120 minutes in this period of time.
Yes.
Like if you would have asked me in 1990, this would have been right in the wheelhouse of an 120 minutes. And sure enough, thanks to a list you provided to me, there it was in the September 16th and 120 minutes playlist. I think it was like the second or third song played on that episode. So the best song in that playlist I thought was probably Crash by the Primitives.
My favorite one on there is Deeper Shade of Soul.
Deeper Shade of Soul was also on there. It's Too Late by Bob Mould, which we just talked about, was also good.
Yeah.
But that's a cool list. I've never seen that one. And basically the list has a list of most of the 120 minutes episodes and what videos were played. And it is interesting. And it's interesting to kind of follow the transition of alternative music from when 120 minutes came on in the late 80s through, it's still on, I guess, but but through its 90s heyday, it was interesting to see the evolution of all that. I mean, you get to like 1996 and it absolutely falls off a cliff.
Yes, it does. Like, and that's when I was watching it regularly too.
Yeah, it's like the presidents of the United States of America were on it and stuff like that. It was like, ugh. I mean, there's some good songs mixed in there too. And it probably got better as the 90s went on, but man, alternative music was interesting. I mean, you think of genres like from before our time, mm-hmm. and most of them really only lasted like 2 or 3 years. I mean, psychedelic rock or hippie music or, stax soul or afro soul of the early 70s. I mean, none of those genres lasted very long. And neither did a lot of the alternative genres that would have been contemporary to us, whether it's, you know, Manchester that we've talked about here or later on grunge. I mean, they all only had like about a 2 or 3 year shelf life. It's just when you live in the moment and it's contemporary to you, it seems like a bigger deal than it really is, I guess. So,
right. Yep.
I don't know what I meant by all that. I'm just pontificating. But anyway, number 8 for you is Tom's Diner by DNA featuring Suzanne Vega.
Tom's Diner is a real place. It's actually called Tom's Restaurant. It's near Columbia University in Manhattan. And if you've ever seen an episode of Seinfeld, you know what it looks like, because it was used for the exterior shots of Monk's Cafe, where the guys from Seinfeld hung out. And the song describes an actual breakfast that Suzanne Vega had at Tom's when she was a student at Columbia. And she was just taking down notes of what she observed going on around her. The distracted waiter, the woman looking at her reflection in the window, the bells of St. John Cathedral, which was nearby, ringing. And she actually figured out the exact date when she wrote it. Because there's a line that mentions an actor who died when he was drinking. And later on, she remembered that it was William Holden. So it would have been November 17th, 1981, when she wrote it. And it was first released on a compilation in 84, and ended up on her first album twice. It kind of bookended the album. The first version was a cappella, and the second version was an instrumental. And this song was based on the a cappella version. DNA took the vocals and basically chopped them up a little bit. The was actually the outro in Suzanne Vega's version, and they kind of switched it up a little bit so that would be the chorus, and they mixed it together with the beat from Soul to Soul's Keep on Moving. And they didn't have a permission from anybody involved with this, but Suzanne Vega liked what they did with it, so she convinced the record label to just buy the song from them and release it as a single instead of suing the guys. And the song itself is actually somewhat historic too, because there was a German engineer named Karl-Heinz Brandenburg, and he used it to calibrate an audio compression format that he was working on, which was called MPEG-1 Audio Layer 3, or better known to most people as MP3. So this was the first MP3. So,
wow.
Yes.
Neato. It annoys me when we record, these are in MP4 format, like what we record. But for my work one, I always have to convert it to MP3. It's annoying.
Oh, okay.
But it's not hard. It's just annoying. I know exactly what I was doing on the day William Holden died too.
Okay, what were you doing?
I went to school.
Yeah.
It was on a Thursday. I would have been.
That was before I started school, so.
I would have been in fifth grade, so I probably played a little wall ball, some soccer, probably football. Lived in Texas at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming I was watching like Sesame Street or something. So
you were probably watching. Maybe the Smurfs, maybe G-Force. I don't know.
Right. But anyway, number 7 for you, we have The Charlatans UK with The Only One I Know.
Well, we call them The Charlatans UK because they were legally forced to call themselves that, so no one confused The Charlatans, which is what they were really called, with the 60s U.S. group, The Charlatans, because, you know, they were on everybody's minds in 1990. I couldn't even
tell you
what the hell The Charlatans did. But this song is a big-time tribute to turn of the 60s to 70s Deep Purple with the prominent organ. It's basically almost a remake of Hush. Organ in it. And The Charlatans didn't have a whole lot of staying power in the U.S. past the early 90s, but they continue to be viable in the UK well into the late 90s. And they're definitely associated with Madchester, which we've mentioned a few times. They, although they were actually from the West Midlands, which is not where Manchester is, but Charlatans were baggy, which was sort of a description of the Madchester bands, because they wore baggy jeans. They wore floppy hats, sort of part of the rave culture, definitely part of the drug culture of England at the time.
Yeah.
Madchester is definitely associated with ecstasy and all manner of drugs. So, but they're a good band and kind of forgotten about here, which is a shame. They're probably worth a reassessment. But yeah, I like this song. It's pretty good.
Yeah. This is a real good song. And it is kind of almost like a prototypical version of like Britpop too.
Yeah, it is. So good stuff. And but the Charlatans UK had a brief period of visibility here in the US, but it didn't really last much beyond 90-91 ish. So
right. Yep.
Anyway, next up for you, number six is Candy by Iggy Pop with Kate Pearson from the B-52s.
This was the first time I'd heard this one in ages. And the thing that struck me about it this time when I was listening to it is just how good the drumming is on it. So I actually made a point of looking up who was actually playing the drums here. And it was Kenny Aronoff from John Mellencamp's band who played on this album.
Oh, yeah. I seem to remember knowing that for some reason. I can't claim that I knew it right this minute, but now that you mention it.
Right. But I mean, he was doing a lot of session work, and I mean, this album was produced by Don Was, so I'm assuming Don Was just called him in because he was a pro. But this song is Iggy's only hit ever as a performer. He wrote China Girl, which obviously became a huge hit for David Bowie, but this was his only top 40 hit. But the song is Iggy basically pining for an old girlfriend, and Candy was based on one of his pre-Stooges girlfriends, and he picked Kate Pearson to do the other half of the vocals on this because he thought that her voice like sounded rural and kind of like a naive country girl, basically. And also there was a law that like every third song had to have a Kate Pearson guest appearance in 1990. So that's what happened here. But this one's actually aged pretty well. It sounds pretty similar to what X was doing around the same time period. So, but it's not too bad. And one thing I have to point out about the cover art for this is that it was drawn by the same guy who designed the cans for OK Soda, which was Coke's failed attempt at targeting Gen X.
I don't even remember that.
It didn't last very long. I don't think it made it past like testing, but it was basically just like anti-advertising. I mean, it just said, I mean, the name of the soda was just OK. And the soda was apparently just OK. So
because the baby boomers thought Gen X was just OK. Bunch of buttholes.
Yep.
Was it more successful than Like Cola?
No, it wasn't. Like was around for, I mean, most of the 80s, I thought. So
yeah, it was horrible.
It was, yeah. I think it was, wasn't it like sugar free or something like that?
Maybe, whatever it was, it tasted like garbage.
Right. At number five here, we have Living Color with Type.
I'd forgotten all about this song, but this would have been the song on 120 Minutes I would have been into, because it's not as quote unquote moody as UK rock would have been at this point. There's no synths in it at all. I would have been like, yeah, this is more like it. Put more of this shit on. So at that period, I would definitely like songs more that fit just as easily on 120 Minutes as Headbangers Ball, which I guarantee this was probably played on both. So
yeah.
Looking back on it, Vernon Reid's guitar in this song is sort of in Sex Type Thing territory by Stone Temple Pilots, which came out a few years later. They're sort of the bridge between Van Halen in 90s grunge, which is a bridge everybody was looking to cross in 1990. At least that's what this song sounds like. But it's pretty good, though. I mean, in some ways, it sounds better to my ears now than the much better known Cult of Personality does these days. So so not bad. Good stuff from Living Color.
I actually really liked this song at the time.
I did, too. I liked Living Color generally at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of sad that they didn't, like, stick around after this. I mean, I know that they did. I think they kicked out the lead singer after this album or something like that.
Yeah, because he was more of an actor, because he was in, like, it was Corey Glover, and he was in Shit, what's the Oliver Stone Vietnam movie?
Platoon.
Platoon. Yeah, he's in the platoon.
Oh, okay.
He's the guy. He actually is one of the guys who lives at the end of the movie.
Huh. I didn't realize.
There you go. I'm full of Johnny Depp was in Platoon as well.
I did know that for some reason.
You know who else was in Platoon?
Willem Dafoe.
Willem Dafoe was in Platoon, but you know who else? Flegel from the Banana Splits.
Okay.
A lot of people don't know. His role got cut out, so it didn't make the final cut.
Right.
Anyway, next up for you, number four, is Dreamtime by the Heartthrobs.
The Heartthrobs are probably in competition with the Cave Dogs as the most obscure band on my side of the list. They were from Reading, England. They were led by Rose Carlotti and Rachel DeFreitas, who were the sisters of the drummer from Echo and the Bunnymen. And they put out a couple of albums in the late 80s, early 90s. And according to a really boring interview of them that I watched on YouTube, Rose Carlotti supposedly looks like a character from the British soap Coronation Street. But that's it. That's, I mean, pretty much all I can tell you about them. This song is kind of dreamy sounding. It's like half shoegaze, half Pixies. I couldn't imagine this getting on any chart before or after 1990. But it did. So, I mean, they were at the right place at the right time. It made it up to number two here. So, good for the Heartthrobs.
I had no idea about this song, so I went back and listened to it. I thought it was pretty good. It was all right.
Yeah, it's not bad. I mean, not really that memorable, though. But, I mean, it's okay. So
yeah, like a lot of the music on here, frankly. I mean, right. Some of it is. I shouldn't say that, but it's... You know, it's just, it's of its time.
Definitely, definitely. But number three for you, we have NXS with Suicide Blonde.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Everybody in the video, stop running at me. That's getting on my nerves. So if you don't remember, and if you were around in 1990, I don't know how you couldn't remember, because I think MTV literally devoted an entire channel to this video. But there are models running towards you on camera in very 1990 era graphics, but technology. So this is Michael Hutchence, the lead singer of NXS, is probably at his most obsessed with Mick Jagger, I think. I mean, from his look at the time to his singing, I didn't really make the connection at the time, and maybe this is a stretch, but it seemed like this song sort of is trying to combine Miss You and Emotional Rescue into like one song.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more Emotional Rescue, but without the cheesy, you know, Mick lyrics at the end, or Mick singing at the end. But you know, this isn't my favorite NXS song, but NXS is a pretty cool band. But it does crack me up, because by this period they were, you know, very popular, and it always cracks me up when they tried to feature like the bespectacled guitar and keyboard players in the videos, because it never came off. But
yeah,
this is probably the point in the podcast, based on the title of this song, that you might think I'm going to make a tasteless Michael Hutchence joke, but nope, not going to do it.
Oh, God.
So, no, I'm not doing it.
Okay, so, okay.
However, I do think it's fair to make fun of the silver outfit that he's wearing in the salon scenes of this video. That is definitely fair game. It's a ridiculous outfit. I mean, I don't even know how to describe it. It looks like a silver, like, it'd be like if you took a robe and made it out of the material that you make, like car fenders out of or something. I mean, it's just silly.
Right. Yeah. But one thing that I was going to mention is they had like a reality show in like probably like 2005 or so. Where they're like basically doing an American Idol to replace Michael Hutchence. And the host of that show was actually on this chart earlier on. It was Dave Navarro from Jane's Addiction that hosted that. So
yeah,
don't really lump those two bands together very often.
No, not really. And that's where cool though. I remember when I came up to visit you in Madison and we went to a bar and somebody put like 10 NXS songs in a row on the jukebox. And I was like, oh, well, I still kind of,
yeah,
this,
I
though.
Mean, Kick's a decent album. I mean,
well, but even like, obviously their pre-Kick stuff is really good too. It's actually probably their best stuff.
Right.
But anyway, next up for you is I'm Free by the Soup Dragons.
This is Manchester style reworking of a 1965 Rolling Stones song. And if the Stones had waited like a couple of years to record their own version, it probably would have ended up sounding quite a bit like this, though maybe without like the reggae toasting in it. But the Soup Dragons were from Scotland. They're almost like the Bush to Stone Roses Nirvana. And
yeah.
And they had their roots in a band called the BMX Bandits, which also included members of Teenage Fan Club. And it was kind of almost like a jangle pop, kind of power pop group. But half of the guys went one way, half of the guys went the other way. And they had another big hit probably a year or two after this with Divine Thing. But I was actually surprised to see where this ended up on the Hot 100, because this was on MTV all the time. So I figured it would have done pretty well on the charts, but ended up stalling at 79 on the charts. But obviously much bigger hit here. And it's been used in a lot of ads. And I think it's actually being used by Chase right now in one of their ads, because I mean, obviously it says free in the song. So anything that's free, they're going to go and license this one, but not that bad. And I actually prefer this to the Stones version.
No, you've gone too far. I didn't like the Soup Dragons. I actually, not to the degree I was into Manchester music, which I really wasn't, but they seemed like posers to me, I thought.
They definitely were. Yeah. I yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was just the impression I got at the time. I was like, and it kind of ruined whatever desire I might have had to like delve into that kind of music. Cause I'm like, well, if this is the shit that represents Manchester, I don't even want to listen
yeah,
to it.
Yeah, I can see that.
So
yeah.
It's all your fault, Soup Dragons. Although I didn't mind Divine Thing. That song was okay. But that doesn't really sound like Manchester either. That sounds more like, that's like just a straight up rock
yeah,
song.
Yeah,
really.
Pretty much.
So, yeah. It's all your fault, Soup Dragons.
But anyway, we're up to number one here. Here we go.
Yep.
The Cure with Never Enough.
No, it's The Cure again. I keep getting The Cure. Only this time, they brought their guitars and they kept their synths at home, because this is very, very, very influenced by the Manchester scene. If you didn't know better, you'd think this was the Stone Roses or Charlatans UK or something like that. The song is supposedly a tribute to ecstasy, which would have been very frowned upon in the Manchester culture at the time. They didn't go for that shit. I'm being facetious, of course, but I've never actually done ecstasy, but if I did, I think I'd rather listen to the Charlatans or the Darling Buds or Sex Packets, frankly. So it's actually, by the standards of The Cure, I'm not a big fan of The Cure. It's not that bad, but it feels like they're trying too hard, which it's probably not fair to levy that criticism when I don't like what they do anyway. So it's like, oh, okay, we'll change up our sound so we can get more people into it, like Todd. And it's like, didn't really come off. So, yeah. But by Cure standards, I guess this is okay.
Yeah, so it's not bad.
I'll say.
Yeah.
I'm just not a big fan of The Cure.
Yeah,
so.
Me neither. I mean, some of their songs are okay, but yeah, pretty much.
Their bass line, though, is pretty below average,
right.
I thought, but anyway, that wraps up our trip into the 1990 alternative yep. scene. little crease in time that we hadn't really touched on.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I think I'm going to go to a rave and just hang out all night.
Right. Countdown.
Yeah. What do you have in mind for
us?
Well,
we're going to stay in the alternative chart, but we're going to the end of the 90s, or actually October 3rd, 1998. So it's going to be quite a bit different from this one. So.
All right. Sounds like fun. In October 1998, I was living in Louisville,
Kentucky. I was living in Cincinnati, Ohio. Yep.
Yes, you were.
That's what I used to come down to your place and we'd play door soccer.
Door soccer? I don't remember that.
Yeah,
we did.
Like one door at one side of your apartment was a goal and one door was the other. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did do that.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. It was a good pitch for floor soccer. Yeah. And also one time you came down and I had a complete infestation of bugs. Remember that?
Yeah.
That's because I lived above a crawl space in my apartment building and all these gnats decided to come up through my drain and basically be born, for lack of a better way to put it. That was gross.
Yeah, it was pretty gross.
We literally had to bug out of the apartment for like 5 hours to bomb it. That was the only time that ever happened too, and they all came up out of the drain. And I used to have all these crickets from like down in the Ohio River that found their way to my apartment, and they would bite me sometimes. I mean, people don't think crickets can bite; they do bite, and they hurt. Just speaking from experience.
That's never happened to me before.
You've never been bitten?
No, I haven't.
It hurts. Yeah, those fuckers would bite me all the time. So, and yet, I have fond memories of that place for some reason.
Yeah,
so,
it was in a decent neighborhood, I guess. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The neighborhood was awesome. So, not Louisville's having a little bit of trouble these days, though. So, probably not the right time to go back and go down there.
Right,
anyway.
Yeah.
So, anyway, thanks everybody for listening to With a Bullet. We'll be back again next week with 1998.
Yep. See you then, everybody.
Are you coming in or are you going to piss about all day?
You're bloody finished. You know that, Jack. I'm bloody finished, you.